This is Sam Robson with the CDC Museum here with Dave Daigle. Today is June 7th, 2016, and we're here in the audio recording studio at CDC's Roybal campus in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm here interviewing Dave about his experiences with the Ebola epidemic for our CDC Ebola Responders Oral History Project. So Dave, thank you so much for being here with me today. Looking forward to hearing about your stories. Can we start off, would you mind telling me where and when you were born?
I was born in August 23rd, 1958, Chisholm, Minnesota.
And did you grow up there?
No, I was a military brat. So my dad was in the Army, and we moved around pretty much until I started high school.
Wow. Where are some of the places you spent more of your time?
Well, let's see. Growing up, Germany. We also lived in different forts, Fort Knox, Fort Stewart. So different posts growing up, yeah. And I think two tours in Germany for him.
Gotcha. And who was in your household?
I'm the oldest of six. So there were, they're a big family. And he retired in 1972. Or right before 1971, and I started high school in 72 in Florida, North Florida.
Gotcha. Did you go through all of high school there?
Yeah, all 4 years at a small town called Green Cove Springs, which is just south of Jacksonville.
What's that like?
It's a very small town, and it was kind of a change because I'd been a military brat and always been in DOD-type school system. So all of a sudden, you were in a small, regular high school. So it was a bit of a change, yeah.
Wow. What kinds of things were you interested in growing up?
In high school, I was a writer. I enjoyed writing for the school paper. Several friends and I were on the school paper. My dad, when he retired from the military, opened up a Dairy Queen in town. So we all the kids worked in the Dairy Queen. His motto was, if you don't work, you don't eat. So we all had no choice. So I went through high school there, and I was on the tennis team, and I wrote for the school paper and worked at the Dairy Queen.
Gotcha. Was it journalistic writing mostly that you were
interested
in?
Yeah, I was in the school paper. I really enjoyed sports. I actually wrote for one of the local papers, too. It was kind of a big deal back then. I was paid, I want to say it was like 70 cents per column inch, and I did all the high school sports. And I at that time, you actually, after the game, you would phone it in. I mean, this was before all the technology. And so you'd actually read your copy on the phone to someone back at the newspaper. But I thought it was kind of neat to do that in high school, yeah.
No doubt. So upon graduation, what were you imagining for your future?
So I had a scholarship to a small college called Flagler College. And it's on the actually in St. Augustine, Florida, on the beach. And so I took my academic scholarship and I went to Flagler, and I did the same thing. I majored in journalism and I was on the Flagler paper. But I ran out of money. I lost the scholarship after the first year, but I kept going to Flagler. So they let me finish out the second year, but then they basically pulled me out of class and said, you really can't keep coming here without paying. So that was my end of Flagler College.
What happened then?
Then I got I went lifeguarding for a while. I was a lifeguard. And after the summer, my dad got very frustrated and said, you can't keep lifeguarding. You've got to do something. And I found a job with 84 Lumber in New Orleans. So I went to New Orleans and I worked 84 Lumber for about a year. And I called my dad up and I said, you know, this really sucks. I mean, I hated it. And I said, I'm either going to go into Peace Corps. At that time, I hadn't even researched the Peace Corps to know that you needed a college degree. But I said, I'm going to go Peace Corps, I'm going to go in the Army, but I'm just not going to come back to 84 Lumber. And he said, you know, the Army's got a program that you can compete. If you have any college, that time it was the Reagan years, and Reagan was, you know, the military was really doing well in Reagan. So basically you would go to the Army basic, and if you did really well, they would pull you out and they would send you back to college to finish up for college. They would pay for your college. So I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and and what they evaluated you on was your physical training, your rifle marksmanship, how well you marched and led. But anyway, I got fortunate, and they pulled me out of the Army, and they put me into college. And I went to Loyola in New Orleans because I really enjoyed New Orleans. Didn't enjoy 84 Lumber, but I loved New Orleans.
Any special memories from basic that you remember?
Oh my gosh, I was terrible at marching. Always have been. So I don't know how I was good at some of the other things, but I did 20 years in the military, and I was always awful at marching. I don't know why. It's very difficult to me. The idea of I could stay in step, but if you're commanding the group or marching folks, you've got to remember what foot to give the command on, and then when you turn or salute, it becomes quite complicated, a lot harder than it looks. But yeah, I do remember being just in fact, later in my career, when there was a big parade, I would have the battalion commander tell me, look, you've got some West Pointer lieutenants, let's let them march the company rather than you, because I was so bad at marching. But yeah, you live with that.
So tell me again where you went after that.
So I went to Loyola University in New Orleans, and I was and then the deal was the Army has paid for my tuition, and so I worked at a restaurant in New Orleans, and the Army paid for my tuition, and I worked my way through Loyola, and I went into the Army as a tank officer.
Gotcha.
In 1982.
Were you still majoring in journalism?
Yes, I graduated with an undergrad in journalism.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So you said a tank?
Tanks, right.
Tanks. Tell me about that.
So
that's amazing.
So what the Army does is in ROTC, and same thing for the West Point, is you, before you graduate, you list what branches you might want to go into, and the branches include infantry, military intelligence, aviation, tanks, and so you list down the different branches. And so my dad had been in tanks, and so I'd listed tanks, I think, in my top three or four. And so, and really, there's no, I don't know how they do it. Some of it's based on how I was a distinguished military graduate, so I think I had a little bit more influence, but some of it's based on your grades and whether you're a distinguished military graduate and your place. The West Pointers, the ROTC, and people who come out of officer candidate school all get put together and sorted out and placed in branches. And so the branch I went to was armor, and at that time, we call it Armor Officer Basic Course, where basically they take people from college or West Point, and they now teach you how to be an Army officer, and also they teach you tanks. And that's at Fort Knox, Kentucky. So I went to Fort Knox, and I went to Armor Officer Basic. And then following Armor Officer Basic, I went to mortar school, but you eventually go to your first assignment in the Army, and mine was at Fort Hood, Texas. And that's essentially where you learn your craft. If you're in tanks or infantry, you're given a platoon. At that time, it was roughly 20 men and 5 tanks, and you work your way up, and the idea is to become a company commander and when you're a captain.
Wow.
So I went from Fort Hood to... went back to, after Fort Hood, you go back to Fort Knox for advance officer tanks. And I did that, and then I went to Germany. And I did a company command tour in Germany.
Wow. Do you remember when that was?
Yeah, Germany was, it was 86 to 89. I was in Germany. I was in Würzburg, Germany, in 3rd Infantry Division. And those were the old days, probably well before you were born, but we used to rush up. At that time, we were all preparing for the Russians to come across the Fulda Gap. And so you had all the Russian forces arrayed, and you had the NATO forces, and certainly at that time it was East and West Germany. And so I had a company of M1A1 tanks, and once a month, oh God, you dreaded this. You would get a phone call, and the phone call would say Larried Advance, and that meant you had 30 minutes to get to the company, 1 hour to be into the motor pool with your weapons mounted and ready to roll out. And so the idea was that, you know, that in Germany, all the forces, at that time, there were over 300,000 Americans in Germany, and we were all there for the Cold War. And we had to be prepared to rush up to our, it was called the German defense, our general defense plan. And we had a place where we were stationed on the border and ready for the forces to come across. And so you would get this call at least once a month. And then sometimes you actually would just go to the motor pool, and all the ammunition's in the tanks and all the weapons are loaded, and you would be told, stand down. Or you would be told, roll to your position, or roll to a gunnery, or roll somewhere else. So we did that. So that was kind of, it was kind of exciting times, but it was, so I did my company command in Germany from 86 to 89. And then the Army offered me, at that time, it was kind of neat. I was fortunate. I had a journalism degree. And the West Point will bring officers out of line units back to West Point to teach. And there was a huge shortage of combat arms officers. And when I say combat arms, guys in infantry, armor, artillery, or special forces are considered combat arms. And other branches are support. And so they had a shortage of officers who had English degrees. Actually, I had very few combat arms officers with English degrees. So I got a call from West Point saying, if you can get accepted into a master's program for English, you can come teach at West Point. And they paid for your master's degree, and then you taught at West Point for 3 years, which was incredible. And so I found Michigan State accepted me under probation. And so I went to Michigan State, And I had to make up a lot of English undergrad hours. They admitted me as an undergrad student. And so and thank God they were on the quarter system, because you can accrue a lot of credits in a quarter system. And so I made up the English hours and got admitted to the master's program for English. And in 2 years I got the master's degree, and then I went to West Point to teach for 3 years, which was really a great assignment, by the way.
What did you teach?
I taught English.
You taught English?
Yeah. So you come in and you teach the 101, the intro to comp, the intro to literature. And then you teach electives later on if you're lucky. And so it was a great assignment. And the guys who go there first of all, you're spoiled as an instructor because you've got West Point cadets, and most of them are salutatorians or valedictorians or high performers. And even when they're not, you're a captain and they're a cadet. So you have the whole military hierarchy reinforced. It's different from being a student and a teacher when you're a captain and they're a cadet. But the people who at West Point was just a great assignment because it brings guys from all across the Army. They've all got master's or PhDs. You're there for 3 years. It was just a great assignment.
Wow.
So I got to do that and then I did, I was assigned to, I call it my punishment tour. In Armor Branch, the guys who run the Armor Branch are tanks. They don't want you to go away for 5 years. The West Point required you to go 2 years of graduate school and then 3 years in tank, 3 years at West Point. So the powers that be say that's 5 years is too long to be away from tanks. And so they don't want you to take the West Point tour. And I took the West Point tour because it was a free master's and a great assignment. And so as my punishment tour was a assignment advising the Louisiana National Guard for 2 years. So I did that for 2 years and loved it. It sounded like a tough assignment, but I had gone to school in New Orleans, and I was out in Lafayette, Louisiana with the Cajuns, and it was a blast. Great people. Just a good assignment. Turned out to be a good assignment. And so then I got a call from Armor Branch saying, okay, you've done your time, and now you can come to Fort Hood, Texas. And the job I had to do, in the Army you have to do certain jobs to advance. So in order to make major, you have to have a successful company command. And so I had done that. I was a major. But I can't become a colonel until I've been a tank battalion executive officer or S3. Those are qualifying assignments. So I was a major in armor, and I needed to be an S3 or I needed to be an XO. And I needed to go to Fort Hood where there were tanks to do that. So Armor Branch called up, and they said, all right, you can go to Fort Hood now. But at the meantime, I got a call from the public affairs folks and at that time, the Army, they wanted you to have a secondary or a specialty, And so public affairs called up, and they said, do you want to go to Hawaii? And that was an old Army gig. Everybody wants to go to Hawaii, right? But they always say that, but no one really goes. So I said, look, guys, I'm a major. I've been around. I know that I'm not going to Hawaii. You guys say that. And I said, where can you realistically send me? And they said, oh, well, we can send you to Germany. So I talked to my wife, and I said, you know, Armor Branch is saying I can go to Fort Hood, and we'd been to Fort Hood. And, yeah, I mean, it's not a great assignment. And then Public Affairs was offering Germany. And I told my wife, I said, you know, the downside is if I take the tanks assignment, then I could probably make lieutenant colonel, but we'll be in Fort Hood. And if we go to Germany, I'll be doing public affairs, but there's a strong chance I won't make lieutenant colonel because in the world of armor, I have not done the right assignment. So she and my wife was adamant. She goes, I do not want to go to Fort Hood. I'd really like to go to Germany. And we had small kids, and we'd done one assignment in Germany, and she just said, why not? Let's go. So we went to Germany, and we did public affairs. And at that time, I got a really interesting account. I was coaching kids soccer. I don't know if you guys are familiar with coaches. Sometimes what they'll do is you put your kids in soccer, and they run out of coaches, and they'll say, all right, your kid, we don't have enough coaches, so if you want your kid to play, somebody's got to volunteer to coach soccer. So I volunteered. And so I'm coaching this soccer team, and it's like five-year-olds, and so, you know, it's mob ball. They wander off the field. The goalie gets a bandage from his mother. It's crazy soccer. And this guy walks up, and he's pulling a cooler full of beer. And he goes, Daigle, you haven't won a game yet. And I said, yeah, well, we're not supposed to keep score, but you're right. We haven't won a game yet. And I don't see winning a game this season. And his kid was the best kid on the team. And I said, and I'll be honest with you, I really apologize. Your kid, Sean, is really good. I mean, if we were on a different team. And he goes, that's all right. That's not what it's about. And he goes, what do you do? And I said, I'm in public affairs. And at that time, I was doing my public affairs assignment. And he says, I'm in a special operations. And I said, what's your name? And he goes, my name's Lambert. And I said, there's a Lambert in Special Operations, but he's a general. He goes, "Yeah, I'm General Lambert." And I'm like, "Holy shit! Okay, I'm sorry, sir." So he started telling me the story about at that time, special operators considered themselves the silent warriors, and so he had gone to Liberia, and they had spent a month in Liberia, and they had evacuated all the Americans. They had stabilized a very tough situation at the embassy. Spent a really hard month there. And the Marines showed up in a Navy ship, and the Marines came off the Navy ship, and they brought reporters. And so he saw all these stories about Liberia, and it was all about the Marines and what great work the Marines had done. But the Marines, basically, the only thing they had done was, you know, allowed the Special Forces guys to leave. But they were smart enough to embed a reporter. And so they had got all this coverage. And it really frustrated the general that they had got all this coverage. And he goes, "You know, we're all fighting for money, and I think the day of being the silent warrior has got to go away." And he asked me if I would do public affairs for the special operators, which to me was really neat because they were doing amazing things, really interesting things. And so I got into public affairs for the special operations. And I did that for my 3 years in European Command. We were at Stuttgart.
Right.
And so that really, to me, it was I think probably got the deployment bug too, because I found that when you deploy, it can be really intense. Especially the first few days of that, or first week or 10 days, it's really exciting, whether you're with special operators or CDC. But I've always enjoyed, you know, being there at the very beginning.
No doubt. Well, yeah, I know that's going to come into play later.
Yeah. And though I saw the, when I was at European Commander Stuttgart, the Navy had sent over a reservist who, her regular job was working at the Centers for Disease Control. And I'd never even heard of the Centers for Disease Control, so I asked her about it. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. But I didn't have an MPH and no background. But I do remember that when I was, after the European Command job with Public Affairs, I went to become a journal editor for the Army. There's a journal called Armor Magazine. It's actually one of the oldest American journals. I think Harper's is older than, actually, it's been continually published going back to late 1800s. It's a very impressive journal. But anyway, so it's a trade journal for tanks and cavalry. So I was the editor at Fort Knox, and I saw a job in journalism. I started my transition about a year out, and I saw a job in journalismjobs.com for CDC looking for a press officer. And I thought, well, I've done public affairs. And that's how I got to CDC. I applied for a job on journalismjobs.com for a press officer.
Wow. I just want to make sure we have the chronology down a little bit. So you were a European Command job that was...
Yeah, that was... European Command was... let's see. 90... I finished that up. No, I'm sorry. 96 to 99.
96 to 99.
1996 to 99. I was in Germany again for... It was called European Command or UCOM in Public Affairs.
Right.
And then from 99 to 2002, I was at Armor Magazine at Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Right.
And I retired in 2002.
Gotcha.
And I retired on a Friday and started at CDC on a Monday in June.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to go, when the Army says 20 years, they mean you have to go to the end of the month. So you think that I entered the Army on, I think, May 16th. So I put my paperwork in for May 16th, and they go, well, you got to go to the end of the month. So you finish out May, and then you start in the... So I started in, at the time, the center was called the National Center for Infectious Diseases. And we've reorganized a few times, but I was a press officer. I was hired as a GS-14 press officer, senior press officer for the infectious disease folks, which to me was fantastic. I was blessed because I had two very patient folks, and Dr. Hughes was the center director, and Dr. Steve Ostroff was a deputy director. I left the Army where I knew public affairs and tanks, but nothing about public health. So I mean, I was trying to catch up very quickly, but there were times where I would get a call about mad cow, and I think it was a joke. You know, it does sound like a joke disease. So I would walk into one of the offices going, is this a joke, or is there really a disease called mad cow? You know, so, but they were tremendously very patient, and I learned pretty much all about infectious diseases during a tenure with NCI. At that time, it was National Center for Infectious Diseases. Then another center, no longer here, was called, what was it called? ZVED, Zoonotic and Vector-Borne Diseases. I joined that center as a, what we call an Associate Director for Communication Science. And I was that, so an ADCS. And I moved to that center. And from there, Glenn Nowak was our director of media relations, and he was posting a deputy position. So I moved over to the deputy for media relations for CDC, and I did that with Glenn for several years and through H1N1. And after that, I went to PHPR as their ADC, and now I'm in NCRD with the National Center for Respiratory and NCIRD, Respiratory right. Infectious Immunization. And so that's where I am right now.
Right. Was there anyone in particular, looking back, who was really helpful in making that transition to public
health? Yeah, there was. First of all, the guys who gave me a chance, Drs. Ostroff and Hughes. I mean, to take somebody right out of the Army with no knowledge of public. But I guess I had the advantage of we had just gone through anthrax attacks. And so the CDC was kind of making a change and realizing that we had to be able to do preparedness, we had to do response, and we had to do better with public affairs. And we had not done well with anthrax on public affairs for a variety of reasons. So I've always thought that Dr. Ostroff, once again, their patience and, you know, having to work with a press officer who was like learning it as he went was amazing. Glenn Nowak, who he now is like a contract employee with us. He's at UGA as a RISCOM professor, but he also works with us. But he was amazing working for him as his, Glenn was an academic and a PhD, and I thought to myself, I'm not sure how good he'll be in media relations, but it was amazing. He has the best instincts I've ever seen, and I kind of let the idea that, oh, you can't be a PhD and be a really good press officer, let that stereotype get in my mind, but Glenn shattered that. It was amazing working for him, learned a great deal. And then I've had other good bosses I try to find. Some of the folks get communications at CDC and some don't. And it's often very difficult to work for a director who doesn't get communications or doesn't put stock into it. I think overall we're doing much better. I mean, we've learned from Ebola and Zika and H1N1 that when something big is going to, communications is going to play a huge role. So we're much better about that now. And that's one of the things I've looked for is directors who are going to give communications a role or make sure that we play that key role that we're going to play.
What, when you look back over the last, so it's been, what, like 15 years or so that you've been at CDC?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. This year, June, it'll be 14 years.
14 years.
Yeah.
Coming up on 15. When you look back on that and think about the communications projects that you were involved in that were really impactful for you, especially thinking about like what later gave you, I don't know, some sort of knowledge about Ebola, tools to deal with that. What would you describe?
You know, one thing I think that helped me was right after I got here, there was a West Nile outbreak in New Orleans, and we didn't really send communicators out, but somebody realized that I had gone out for the Army, so they said, "Would you go out?" I said, "I'm happy to go out." And so I went out for West Nile in New Orleans, but it was kind of strange because I went out and it went really well. We handled the media, we handled the public affairs, we did a lot of health education with the state and local partners. But at some point, it just felt like, you know, I guess I was used to going out in the Army where you go out for a finite period of time. You're going out for 6 months or you're going out for 90 days. So I was sitting in New Orleans and I looked at the team lead and I said, you know, I think I'm pretty much done. And he goes, yeah, there's not much going on now. You've done what you can do. But I was in the military mindset. I'm thinking, well, somebody should tell me to come back. So I emailed or called a couple folks at CDC on the communications chain. I said, should I come? I couldn't even get an answer. So finally, I called up a buddy of mine who was hired on the same day I was, and I said, you know, what do you think? And he goes, I'd come back. This is ridiculous. So I just came back on my own, which was like a huge learning curve for me. And so we were in those days, and then I went out for Katrina, and I went out for a few other things. But we didn't usually send communicators out. And so that was always a huge thing. One is I could go out because I'd gone out before, and there's usually some utility for me going out, whether it was handling the initial crush in public affairs or media relations or doing some health ed. But we didn't send people out, and I don't think we really got it until Ebola. And then in Ebola, for the first time, they really took the communications, in my mind, like we've never had before. We were sending out communicators to do health education, and we had a health promotion team that focused on sending out health educators and people to do campaigns. But we also realized how important the risk communication aspect was, the media relations aspect. And so we had We didn't, I think we certainly could have integrated it better. In fact, the health promotion team kind of worked outside of the JIC. But we did, in my mind, we went from not sending communicators out or not even thinking about sending communicators out to really realizing how important it is not only to send communicators out, but to send out, like I say, a wide array of communicators from those who do promotion and campaigns to risk, comm, and public affairs.
Right.
So you kind of watched, in my mind, I was able to see the evolution from, you know, there are many outbreaks where I thought, gosh, I wish we could have sent somebody out there. And what often happened in the old days was the team would get on the ground and there would be a huge need for somebody to do risk, comm, or public affairs because reporters were there. And our guys were reluctant to engage with the reporters or tell the CDC story without a communicator there. And so by the time that they figured out it would be a good idea to send a communicator, it was often, we couldn't have gone out there in time and it would have been a waste anyway. So we were constantly, in my mind, fighting the battle of trying to convince a lot of our scientists and researchers that you need communications out there, whether it's for public affairs or for a campaign, but we can really be a multiplier and help in this. But I don't think as an agency we came around to that really and understanding and appreciating communications until Ebola.
Yeah. Can you, when you look back, just to get some like tangible examples, especially can you tell me about a time when CDC really could have used communicators and didn't, and it would have improved the response?
Right. There were several responses. I think, let's face it, the media. If we look at the media, I think it's. For our guys, it's they when they go out on an outbreak, they want to focus on doing the contact tracing or whatever needs to be done, to end the outbreak. But the other part of this is, and the same thing that Special Forces General realized is that you have an audience, and you have to convince that audience, whether it's the policymakers or the folks around the Beltway, that you're doing something that's really remarkable, and it needs to be funded. And so we're all competing for funding dollars. And so oftentimes I think that we would send folks out for an outbreak that was incredibly interesting. And we knew that the media wanted to go and they would cover it. And it would help us tell the story of CDC. I'm afraid that probably before Ebola, when you thought of CDC, you thought of our labs. And you knew that we had great labs and we did lab work. But you didn't know that we were going to all around the world working on a lot of outbreaks. And there's work that we would do, like meninge in Africa, that would get no attention. And even discovering a vaccine or working toward a vaccine. And there were incredible work that we were doing globally that no one knew about. And I don't think people even knew that CDC had this capacity. So we weren't telling the CDC story. And we probably were not getting credit for a lot of the work we're doing. And it took up, in some ways, I hate to keep going back. I think it can actually go back to H1N1 or SARS, where the idea of being in a global village and something that started in the hotel metropole for SARS in Hong Kong could come to Canada, could come to the U.S., for us to start understanding that all this work that we're doing globally, all that is really important. And this is why it's important, because whatever starts in Hong Kong can be within 20 hours in the U.S. So I think a lot of opportunities were missed early on, the work that we were doing on the outbreaks, the work that we were doing with the locals. You know, I don't think a lot of people understand that when a local health department has an issue, something big, a measles or something, that they call on CDC and that we go down and we work with the local health department. And I just don't think that was ever, you know, you thought of us, you thought about the labs, but you didn't see the guys who, the EPIs, you didn't see the global work. So I think we missed opportunities on many outbreaks where I would have reporters call up or 60 Minutes and say, we'd love to cover this outbreak.
Do you remember one in particular?
I remember 60 Minutes. A couple of times we turned 60 Minutes down on my watch where they wanted to go out to Uganda where we were working on an outbreak of either Marburg or Ebola. And, you know, that would have been amazing exposure because, really, it's a great story. I mean, these guys are doing incredible work, sometimes under really difficult conditions. I went to Ouija Angola as part of a WHO team. And we embedded, New York Times, BBC, really huge outlets were wanting to tell that story. And we did amazing work and that we watched the donations of WHO climb. But, you know, it was just a matter of putting, you know, being able to tell the story of an amazing outbreak and some incredible work being done at the time. And so I do think we may have missed opportunities. But just because the mindset was, you know, we want to focus on fixing this outbreak or fixing or remedying the situation. And like I say, until Ebola, then it seemed like, even H1N1 and SARS, we didn't really get. And it's funny because I watched this happen in the Army. In the Army, You know, if we go back to Bosnia, we were telling the public affairs guys in the army were telling people, we need to embed journalists. And there were so many fears about embedding journalists. Oh my God, you know that our troops are got, most of them have high school educations. There's no telling what they'll say. Well, what we found out is that when you put even the most jaded and professional journalists, you put them with American soldiers for 3 days, they bond. They become, and it, we saw it in, and then you watch the first Desert Storm. And let me tell you, the Army was terrified of this, but they took that big step. And the stories that we got from embedding journalists were incredible. And the journalists will come back and they said, we felt like we were part of the team. I still keep up with the guys that you put me with on that tank or whatever. And so I kind of knew from my Army days that I thought if you could do the same thing, if you could put journalists with these epis in the field, they'll appreciate, one, how difficult this is, how tough the situation is. And by the way, these guys are doing incredible work under usually very difficult conditions. And so many of us were pushing for, you know, embedding or telling the story better, because it's such a great story. It's like, in my mind, it was just like the Army story. I said, there's not a reason not to put these journalists with these soldiers. I mean, if you look back, I mean, the tremendous stories that came out of that. And like I said, and to this day, I still talk to journalists who I either embedded or embedded with, and they just feel that bond.
Right. So what were you working on immediately before the Ebola response?
I was the ADC for Public Health Preparedness and Response, the center that has the EOC, the stockpile, and a couple.
Gotcha.
I had started off, Ebola started off as a, we weren't a level one activation. It was a lower level activation. So John O'Connor, who's in the Infectious Disease Center, who's my colleague, he's the ADC for the Infectious Disease Center, asked me if I would run the comms for that. We didn't activate the JIC, so we were on a lower level. So I was running the actual comms for in the EOC for Ebola. And then it got kicked into high gear. It may have been the missionaries. Something, I think we got kicked into high gear. And I remember Dr. Frieden, it was around 7 or 8 August. He was in D.C. and he told policymakers it was his goal to get 200 CDCers in West Africa by next week. And then he came back on Friday and he said the same thing, I think, in a press conference. And so we went to level one activation. And I got a call that Sunday. I was actually at Falcons training camp. And I got a call saying, can you be in Nigeria by Wednesday or Thursday? We took off Wednesday, and we didn't have visas. I mean, we were just kind of thrown in there. So we left for Nigeria, and other folks were going. I mean, Nigeria had new cases. I think I wrote it down. Their first case, Nigeria. So their first case, 20 July, it was imported, the first person, and then he died on 25 July. And I want to say by 8 August, we got the word that there was a team going. Fortunately, there were folks already in Nigeria. One thing that was so good about Nigeria is that we had been working on polio in country. And the work that the global guys had done in polio was, oh my gosh. We got there and they already understood EOCs. There was also a really good program working with FELTP. So we were able to piggyback off some amazing work done by the polio folks. So our team kind of came in behind and worked with the polio folks who were already in country. But we were just so blessed to have a lot of that stuff going on in country already. And there were relationships that the global had already established and that we were just able to leverage. So we were, I think we got to polio, there was about 10 or 12 of us in addition to the folks already there for polio.
Were you with the first group from Atlanta who went out to?
Yeah. Yeah. There was the very first group. He was trying to get, I want to say, he set up to 200. I don't know how many we actually got, but there was a group of us that went to Nigeria, then Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone as well.
Gotcha.
And they pushed everybody out the door. There were people in country already, obviously, but this was a group that was coming in to help.
So what did you find in Nigeria?
Well, we found it was pretty chaotic. I mean, Nigeria was the first time in Lagos where I guess a great fear was realized. It's a city of 21 million people, and they're jammed very tightly. So I think that was always one of the great fears about Ebola is what would happen if it got into a densely populated urban center. I mean, before you'd go out for like Ebola or Marburg, and it would be in a very remote area. Wijangola was remote, and it would usually burn out. But the idea of having it in this very dense city was terrifying. So one of the first things we did was there were, I think at the time, 12 cases, and we had to begin contact tracing. So I think it got up to about 200 people that were doing the tracing on. But we also had to, working with our partners, we had to come up with a facility to put the patients. And so we quickly converted, I think it was an old TB hospital, into an isolation ward. And so they got an isolation ward set up. And we started working. It was amazing. They stood up this kind of ad hoc communications group, and there was a UNICEF communicator. There were some college kids. There was a professor from one of the universities, and so we started we really went into the ICS, the incident command structure, and with communications as part of that. So I was doing as far as communications. I was working with. We also have a consulate in Lagos. And so with an outbreak like this, there was intense media interest. So we were working the public affairs aspect with our State Department folks at the consulate in Lagos, and as well as Atlanta and everybody. So there was the aspect of the media relations and public affairs. But there was also, we stood up kind of a social media arm and the Lagos guys were amazing. Some of these young kids in college putting together social media campaigns, leading Twitter chats. We hooked them up with CDC, and we did a Twitter chat that was one of the largest ever, with kind of from Nigeria working with CDC Atlanta. So there were some amazing things. And it was really a need for it, because we would see these crazy rumors and they would just take off. I remember the day after I got there, we're looking at a headline of the paper that said something about salt water possibly curing Ebola or preventing it. And so then we initially go into a campaign, one to help educate, but also to do some rumor busting. There were rumors about coconuts or a certain kind of nut that would also prevent it. So there was a lot being done very quickly. And then just getting educational materials in place. And a lot of the stuff we were pulling straight from Atlanta and trying to get to our counterparts.
No doubt. What were some of the... So it sounds like you were mostly engaging with the Nigerian media at that point?
No, actually a lot of the international media as well. We were doing... It's amazing how many dailies there are. And there must be certainly over 10 dailies in just in Lagos. So there's a very aggressive local media. But then there's a lot of bureaus, and there's a lot of international media as well. So we were doing New York Times, we were doing BBC, there were quite a few interview requests. And so you have a team leader who, you know, part of it, he has to do that, but he's also running a very busy team. So part of that was working on the messaging, getting all the messaging and the materials ready, coordinating that with both State and Atlanta so that we could do the interviews. And then carving out some time where the team leader would do the interviews, but keeping in mind his primary job is to work on the outbreak. So a lot of that was public affairs, but also plugging into their version of a joint information center, the Nigerians, and working with our partners. There was an amazing woman there from UNICEF who was huge, very helpful.
Do you remember her name?
First name was Sunny, and I have it written down in my I gave my green book to the museum.
Oh, to Louise.
Yeah, she grabbed it. But it would be in that green book, her name and number for Sunny. But Sunny and I went on it was so funny, we were sitting in the EOC, and I'd never had this happen before, but we were sitting there working on something, and they rushed up to us and they said, there's a media riot at the isolation ward. And we're like, media riot? I'd never seen a media riot. So they said, you've got to go get it in the vehicle, and you've got to go down there and handle the media riot. And I'm thinking, what does a media riot even look like? Are they throwing pins? Or what are they doing? I mean, what does a media do when they riot? How threatening can they be? So we drove down to the isolation ward, and there indeed was, I wouldn't call it a riot, but there was certainly a standoff. And what had happened was, the journalist, somebody from inside, one of the patients had obviously called a relative, and done either did a long interview with a relative, or the relative was sitting with a reporter. So anyway, one of the dailies publishes a long interview from an Ebola patient, and it was the first. Well, if you're an editor or if you're a producer, you're very upset. If you're a competitor, how come they've got the story? You don't have the story. What's wrong with you? And so they were convinced that we were letting reporters into the isolation ward. That's how he got the story. So now the other reporters, both broadcast and print, were demanding to get into the isolation ward so they could do a story, and because they were already scooped or beaten into the punch. And so, and of course, the isolation ward, the people running the ward, nobody was getting in there. So there was a bit of a standoff, and the reporters were getting mad, and they had these guys from security at the hospital. So fortunately, Sonny, who normally worked in Lagos and spoke multiple languages and knew some of the reporters, and we were able to quickly convince the reporters, one, nobody had an exclusive. There were no reporters in there. The reason the story happened was somebody could call out. And if you could get a patient to call out, you could do an interview as well. But we were not letting any reporters in, or family members. In that case, it was either you were either a healthcare worker or you were a patient. That's the only people going in. And so once we got, it took a little while, I think about a half an hour of getting both sides cooled down. Of course, the hospital was very excited too, because all these reporters were calling, they were raising accusations that you were letting some reporters in, but you're not letting others in. That wasn't the case. And so that was the first media riot, and I worked it with Sonny from the UNICEF, who was fantastic.
Wow. And it sounds like, I mean, a huge concern during that is just patient privacy and maintaining that.
And that was the interesting thing. I guess my first experience was there wasn't much patient privacy. And, you know, we do a really, that's one thing about, that's kind of the gold standard at CDC. I've been in situations where reporters have come to me and they said, I know so-and-so is a patient. I've already talked to their parents. Their parents have told me everything. I just need you to confirm this. And we still will not confirm the patient's name. We'll protect the patient's. And so I'm sitting there in Lagos one morning, and I see on the front page of one of the dailies a picture of the infectious disease doc. Actually, the woman we believe who may have recognized what patient zero had was not malaria but Ebola, but she became a patient and she was in the isolation ward. So the paper had her released, Dr. So-and-so released from or cured from isolation ward. Well, I called my buddy up who knew about that, and I said, was Dr. So-and-so released? You know, it's above the fold on the front page of this paper. And he goes, no, in fact, she's in really bad shape. Well, the next day she dies. And so they not only did they publish her picture and identify her in one daily, but then they had it wrong. So they listed patients' names and they provided that. So it was a whole different. And so you're trying to do, you know, the CDC rule and protect patients. And they're like, no, we know their names and their pictures are in the paper. And the other thing too that surprised me, I remember my first press conference, and things are, you know, every outbreak is different and every country is different. And I remember going to this press release, and it was the Minister of Health leading the press conference from Nigeria. And I was like my second day in country, and I was still working on my messaging and the materials that we would use for public affairs guidance. And he got a very difficult question. And I thought to myself, this would be great. I really need to know what we're saying on this answer. And as soon as he got that answer, he goes, he looked at the reporter, he goes, that is a stupid question. Escort this reporter out of here. He threw the reporter out of the press conference because he asked this really tough question. And I thought to myself, well, that's one way to handle that question. But I've seen reporters, and the reporters are different. And over there, they don't make any money as reporters. So most of them are doing it either as a second job or on the side. So I really had some sympathy for reporters because they had to work so hard to do what they were doing. And oftentimes they weren't as professional as our reporters, but keep in mind they weren't full-time reporters. Most were doing it on the side. And it's a tough story to tell over there when you ask a tough question, you're escorted out.
Well, and it sounds to me like another golden standard that you're talking about through your past is building relationships with the press. You know?
Yeah, and that's, I think, if you look at the really good press officers, CDC or the Army, they all have relationships with the press where, you know, and that, you know, it's nice to be able to call a New York Times reporter or a Wall Street Journal, and one, they'll take your call because they know that you have that relationship. Yeah. So that does help, because there are times when we have to reach out to reporters, and if you have that relationship, it's a big help.
Right. So thinking about your experience in Lagos, one thing you mentioned that I've heard before is this, like, idea of the saltwater bath and potentially using that as a cure for Ebola. How do you gear your messaging about that while maintaining respect for local understandings of illness.
You know, and that's in fact, for what we did for that one was the social media team that was literally standing up when that happened was so aggressive and so good. They went right to work trying to combat that. And we were reaching out, we were sending out text messages. Everybody's on a cell phone there at that time. So we were able to text out messages, but we were also able to use Twitter and social media. Still, I saw headlines from other papers were reporting two people had died from consuming too much salt water. So I just worried that, you know, that we weren't able to reach everybody as quickly as possible. But social media and texting out messages to cell phones were really working well. Plus, you know, the radio and newspapers, too. I won't even say mainstream media, because the radios, every morning I would, you know, we try to get our guys or the Nigerian experts on the local radio stations, and you could hear them being interviewed on the way in. So we were working pretty aggressively to try to get the word out. But we, when you say, the first step is to use the local guys and the experts that they recognize. And so, you know, we had several Nigerian doctors who were fantastic, who came right up and were willing to be interviewed. And in some cases, it was just giving them the information that they needed to have for Ebola and helping them do the interviews. And so I think it was much better if it was able to come from somebody from Lagos or Nigeria. You know, and you know, there's that distinctive accent that you recognize, and you know you're not talking to a WHO or CDC guy. And so in my mind, it was much better to help them do good interviews and get them the information, because the audience would recognize them automatically. Once they started speaking, they heard that accent, they knew they were a Nigerian or from Lagos.
Did you have to do much just learning about how people understood like health and illness in order to communicate?
You know, in some cases, and every country is different, but I'm always very fortunate to have, if we have somebody like a Sonny who had been working in UNICEF in Lagos for some time, you know, it's always good to have, if you have somebody on the team who's from that area and understand it. I've also worked with, like, I was in Angola with an anthropologist who was out of the capital of Luanda. She was amazing, and I remember we actually, in going to skip over to Marburg one time, there was, when the WHO team had showed up, the military had been handling Marburg. And so the military would get a call about a suspect patient, and they would literally come up to the hut. And these guys in PPE with rifles would pull everybody out of the hut and throw them in a truck, or maybe pull one family member out of the truck, and they would drive away. And if nobody knew where they were going, nobody knew what was happening. And so this had been going on for a period of time. So that now the WHO team comes in. Well, the first time the WHO team starts going out, people are rocking vehicles because they're fed up now. And we don't know what Marburg is. We don't know what's happening to our... And so we had to stand down there for a weekend and spend a weekend going out to the different barrios and talking to the chiefs or the elders and explaining that, you know, this is where, when somebody's sick, this is where they're going. And then there were several things we had to put in place. One was that nobody from the WHO team would visit a hut without somebody from the village, like the elder or chief. Or two, that we'd always coordinate those visits in advance and trying to give them, a buy-in, if you will. But I was in one of those vehicles that was rocked, and they would throw rocks. And at first you're like freaking out, but then when you think about it, what they had been going through with the military, who hadn't told them anything, they would pull a relative out, and you don't know where the relative was going. And so you had to kind of – so I've been in situations where – and this is where the anthropologist was fantastic, because she knew the people. She knew the country. And, you know, and I would say that weekend stand down where we spent the weekend just doing community reach out really helped.
Did you have anthropologists in Nigeria?
No, we didn't. But there are other places in other countries where some of the anthropologists were, and it does make a big difference. Because, I mean, yeah, we say this about going into Nigeria, but it's no different than, like, if you go to Indiana for MERS, and, you know, you're coming from Atlanta, and you know, it's still the U.S., it's Indiana, but that communicator, that state health communicator, they still will know their audiences better than I do. So the one thing I think whenever I come in with the CDC team is I try to, you know, meet with those guys and find out, you know, who are the reporters that you're concerned about? What are the outlets that you're training on? And trying to get a lay of the land, if you will. Whether, even if it's, I don't think, in my mind, Nigeria is no different than I've gone to domestic outbreaks where I'm American, but I don't know their audiences. I don't know their media as well as they do.
Do you, I want to make sure we have this, like, for the kind of metadata or what have you. Do you remember, what did you have, like, a formal position, quote unquote, in Nigeria?
What do they? Usually they just call the communications.
Just yeah. communications. Just yeah. on the team for communications.
Yeah, that's one thing too. There's usually only one. If communications gets on the team, it's only usually one person.
You're the team.
So the communications you can do in the field can be social mobility or health education. You could be asked to do a campaign. You could ask to write speeches. I've had to write speeches for councils or team leaders. You'll have to do. I promise you, you'll have to do public affairs or media relations. Because there'll be such intense interest. And the fifth thing, of course, you'll have to do risk communication, because now that's become such a big deal, our brand and risk reputational management. So I will tell communicators, let's say that you view yourself as a health educator or somebody who's done campaigns. Well, that's fantastic, and that will probably be very helpful. But you should be, if you're going to go out on a team, you should be also able to write a speech for the State Department guy. You better be able to talk to the New York Times, because when that New York Times person walks up, there's only one communicator on the team, and you can't say, I'm a health educator. And I've seen that happen, where we send out a health educator. When I try to train my guys to go out, I'll say, I understand that you don't like doing media relations, but you've got to be able to do it, because nobody else on the team, when a reporter walks up, they're going to look to you to do that interview, or look to you to help them get ready to do that interview. So when we do send it, that's why on the team, you'll be labeled a communicator, but you'll be expected to do, I would say, the gamut or a whole range of communication activities.
Gotcha. I was going to ask you the question. Were you the one who was organizing interviews? I know you did a lot of that and getting the local experts there and on the radio and on the news. Or were you doing more interviews yourself? Did you also do interviews yourself?
The first choice is to get your guys to do interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if what I want to do is there's a couple things. You have a team leader, and you want your team leader. We'll identify in advance who should do the talking. And so ideally it's a team leader. But remember, the team leader is so busy. And the other thing I'll do is, this is often an opportunity for EIS officers. So you like to get them to do some interviews, but you want to set them up for success. You want the interview to go very well. So what I'll do, time pending, is I'll try to get everybody on the team to do interviews. Some guys will not do interviews. If you come up to me early on in the outbreak and say, I want to do interviews, I'm your guy, and I cross you off my list, because you'll never do an interview because you want to do one. I would rather somebody be very nervous about it, not want to do one. The people who want to do interviews always scare me. But what I'd like to do is I'd like everybody on the team, especially EIS officers, if I can get them at what I call a low-threat interview, to do an interview. But in the end, you end up doing interviews because there are so many requests, and your team leader literally cannot do them. So what I like to do for my team leader, when we're out there and we're getting, let's say we have 10 to 12 requests, I'll go to, at that time in Nigeria, it was John Verdefe, and I'll say, John, here's the interviews I think you have to do. This is New York Times, this is BBC, this is LA Times. I need you to do those three. Block out 40 minutes for me. And he'll carve out 40 minutes, and we'll do bam, 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 those three interviews. The rest of the ones I'll do. And so what we'll do is we do as many as we can, but I'll try to triage it so I get the best bang for the buck for the team leader. And I won't waste John's time on the Poughkeepsie, whatever, or this. But we can identify the audiences that we really want to reach and have a big bang. That's what I'll try to, and it's tough because those team leaders are working so hard. But the good ones will say, Dave, I'll do it, but you've got to, it's got to be, you have to maximize. I'm going to give you an hour to do interviews. And so in that 1 hour, you better pick the interviews that you want him to do. And so the other interviews, you'll either get other team members to do it, or you'll do it.
Gotcha. I know we have a lot more of your response to get to, but looking back on your time in Nigeria, do you remember the span of time you were there?
I think it was about 3 weeks.
About 3 weeks, yeah. So the month of August.
Pretty much,
from
August
8th or so on. Okay.
And then I came back and I worked in the JIC for a couple weeks because John O'Connor had basically been nonstop in the JIC. So I went in the JIC and he took leave for a couple weeks.
Gotcha. Looking back on Nigeria, any other memories of any incidents
I was out at the isolation ward. The original isolation wards were, it was awful. In fact, I got pictures of it. It really was a shack, and it was awful. And we were out there, and we were looking at the new, the old isolation ward and where we were going to put the new one. And there was an old WHO colleague I knew from Marburg, and he's a character. And he was training people on how to don PPE, and he's actually working in the isolation ward. And so we were standing out there, and he asked if anybody had a book. And I had to teach Shakespeare at West Point. So I one thing I've learned about deployments is always have a book, because invariably you're either traveling somewhere or you're waiting for me. So it's so happy to have. So I'll usually take two or three paperbacks, a couple classics, and I'll just have something to read. And he asked if anybody had a book. And it turned out in the isolation ward, there was literally nothing. I mean, if you can just think, not even a latrine or a sink. And so these poor people are in this building, and there's nothing to do except watch each other. And so I gave him Henry V, Part One, and he went in there and he started acting it out and then told the story to the New York Times. But it was so great. Eventually, we were able to round up more donations of magazines and books. But that was the first book to go into the isolation ward. And he was amazing. And he told this great story about how he was acting it out for the different patients, because literally there was nothing in there. So that I remember the book. Nigeria. It was a really good team in Nigeria. We had... You tend to bond real quickly as a team, and I always enjoy that aspect. I mean, you in Lagos, you were working, or when you weren't working, you were shuttled back to the hotel, and you had to stay in the hotel because there were like curfews and you couldn't go out at night. So you do end up being very close with the team, and we had a really strong team there. So I enjoyed that. I ended up writing, you've probably seen it, a little blog for CNN. And that way I talked about what a great team. It was one of the best teams I've been on, and I still see some of the guys from the teams. So I think from Nigeria, I thought that team was a lot of fun, and it was really good working with them.
Briefly, anyone who sticks out in your memory?
It sticks out because it's kind of funny. There was a guy named Brian Christensen, and we nicknamed him Meat Pie, and that nickname has stayed with him. And there was one day they brought out these meat pies. I ran on 4 o'clock in the EOC. And they were like room temperature meat pies. And a lot of us were looking, and I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know. But Brian ate like 4 of them. He's a big guy. So the next day, he's throwing up, and he's diarrheaing, and it's all coming out of him, all orifices. And he's taking the Cipro, and he can't go out in the morning because he can't leave the toilet. And I think I made the joke about, calling him meat pie. And unfortunately, that has stuck with him. And I said... because of these dreaded meat pies. And he really was the only one. I mean, the rest of us looked at the meat pies. I'm like, I don't know about it. We didn't know what the meat was. And I'm just like, I'm not sure. They were just room temperature. There was a lot of shady stuff going on there. I mean, I think most times in Africa, at one point or another, you're going to get traveler's diarrhea. It's just a matter of time. But I mean, something you can put it off and you can try to make good judgment. But I think eating 4 meat pies at one sitting was just did them in.
Right. So anything you remember, especially from that couple weeks in the JIC?
The JIC, that was amazing. It was good to give John a break. And it was also... It was good to see a different side of it, too, because I'd been in Nigeria, but also to see the craziness of the JIC, and they work incredibly hard, and so it was interesting. I think they were probably ready for me to go, because I had a tendency to bring a more of a field aspect to it, going, guys, this is ridiculous. We're working way too hard on something that's insignificant. So I think they were probably ready for me to go as well, because I after having been deployed, you have a whole different sense of, we really don't need to spin up on this. And I mean, there's this crazy system where they have these JIC addresses, and they send everything to you not as Dave Daigle, but as JIC lead. And so I got to a point where I said, I'm no longer able to keep up or read these things. If you want to send me an email, just send it to DRD4 or Dave Daigle. Because you can't read the emails. There's so many people, and they're all creating emails, and you just, like, forget it. So the JIC was interesting, and it was good to see that side of it.
What media relations things were you, what kind of messaging were you doing?
Oh, no, I was the JIC lead then, so I was running all the Joint Information Center so John could go away.
Is that mostly an administrative position then? Or?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Okay. There's a series of teams inside the JIC, and you're basically all the teams report to the JIC lead.
Gotcha.
And you're the co-lead.
Yeah. Okay, what happens after that?
After that, I went back to my day job, and in September, the end of September, we had Dallas. Dallas came up. And I was on, it was a Tuesday, and I was on leave. And John called me up, and he said, at noon, he called me up. He goes, can you go to Dallas? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you should pack. And then at 3 o'clock, he told me, go to the airport, and we don't know what flight you're going to be on yet, but if you get to the airport, we'll figure it out. And I got to the airport, like, about 4 o'clock, and I had tickets for Dallas. I remember waiting for my flight, and a reporter from a Dallas broadcast station called me up. And I thought, this is amazing. One, he knows I'm going. Two, he's got my cell phone. And the reporter said, will you do an interview? And I thought to myself, yeah, I'll do an interview if you can find me. And I said, sure, I'll do an interview if you can find me at the airport. And thinking that I would just be able to walk right out of the airport. And boy, that was another learn. I learned then that was pretty foolish of me, because they had staked out baggage claim and they had found a picture of me, and I ended up doing a stand up at baggage. So, but that also to me that kind of showed me the sense of the media was in Dallas was a bit insane.
No doubt.
Yeah, so it was a bit crazy, and that was the first taste of it, doing a stand up at baggage claim.
Does that mean a stand up interview?
Yeah.
What is that?
Oh, that's where that camera, the reporter's right there, and they put you right on the air with a camera.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so it was pretty crazy. And so I was quickly able to tell the other CDC folks. I got there first. Like, I caught the earlier flight out. The rest of the team came in by sometime before midnight, and I was able to call them back saying, all right, just, you know, we've already done an interview. Just pick your bags up, get your rental cars, and we'll see you to the hotel.
Do you remember what agency that was with?
I don't remember. I could probably find out. Okay. I'll go back and look at my voucher.
Okay, that's cool. So and you eventually get on the flight. You go to Dallas.
Yeah, go to Dallas. And we get to Dallas is insane. We get there. Everybody closes by Tuesday night. And on Wednesday morning, we go to the hospital. We meet Wendy Chung from the county health department. And we get going in Dallas. And Dallas was crazy. I can remember that in that very first day, it's the judge, who's the highest elected official for Dallas, Judge Jenkins, and the mayor, Mike Rawlings, were in this room. And I'm in the room. The team lead at the time was David Kuhar. And David Kuhar wanted to be at the hospital. He's a hospital infection guy. So pretty much what we did was he told me, if you can keep the judge and mayor happy and that side of the house, because he was at the hospital and they wanted to find cases at the hospital and do the contact tracing, which was really critical. So I was left there at the judge's office with the judge and the mayor, and there was a phone call, and it was I had been to Dallas before, and I knew Judge Jenkins because I'd worked at West Nile. They'd had a West Nile kind of crisis, so I knew Judge Jenkins from that. And Judge Jenkins was on the phone with Dr. Frieden. He says, well, Dr. Frieden, what do we do next? The CDC is running this. And I remember thinking to myself, I think Judge Jenkins knows that we don't run this. We never run this. We come in and, you know, and Dr. Frieden was very good. Dr. Frieden says, no, Judge Jenkins, CDC's not running this. This, you need to stand up under the ICS, get an EOC, designate a lead, and get going on this. And so they designated the state health officer at that time was David Lakey. And so he designated David Lakey as the lead, Dr. Lakey, and they stood up not one, but two EOCs. The state stood one up, and Judge Jenkins stood one up. And the Dallas began. And then for the immediate concern at Dallas was to identify the contacts and do the tracing on the contacts. And there were two sets of contacts. There were contacts from the hospital, and then there were other contacts on the outside, the people in the taxis and things like that. So it was very aggressive working. And then there were all these issues that just came because it was the first Ebola in the U.S. Issues like, you know, what does the hospital do with the sanitation issues? There were crazy issues that seemed to come up that just was a really strange time.
No doubt. Two EOCs.
Made it to the state one. The state apparently had one set up somewhere in Dallas. I never made it out there. And I did go to the, I was going to the Dallas one pretty much daily. And we joked, you remember Amy, we just met out by, so we had to set somebody, when the city stood up their EOC, they wanted somebody from CDC there. And the CDC folks who were pretty much the team was all infection control folks and EPIs, and they were working on the contact tracing, they were working on infection control issues. So we really didn't have anybody to sit in the EOC and say, I'm CDC. Because I was going back and forth between the hospital. So that's when I called John up and I said, send me a communicator or a PHA. I just need somebody to be a CDC presence in this EOC. And so we jokingly call it Team Cobra. At that time, we were different teams. And once again, there was only one communicator. That's me. And so instead of I had a little room in a hospital. We had several offices in this hospital, and on the door was it was Epi Team, and it said Communications. And so I just crossed off Communications, and I wrote Team Cobra. So because I'm going with the old Army, Army always gives sexy names, Operation, whatever. So I went Team Cobra, and Amy showed up, and I put Amy into the EOC, and I said, "You're really not doing communications. You are CDC and Judge Jenkins or the city's EOC." And that's what Amy did. And we set up inside that EOC. And I went between the hospital, where most of the CDC was at the hospital, and then there was the judge's EOC. I never made it out to what Texas called their EOC. The state of Texas had their EOC.
Gotcha. Was it? I don't know how frequent it is to have multiple EOCs, but it sounds confusing to me.
Yeah, it was. It was very confusing. And what was difficult for was that them demanding a CDC presence in that in the city's EOC, because really nothing was coming out of that. I mean, it was really the EOC was not very helpful. Mm-hmm. And eventually, we had the incident where was a Friday where we were like, I forgot what day of case the contact tracing, where we pretty much hit a milestone and we didn't think we'd see any new. A great number of us went home on a Friday night. And then on Sunday, we were told we had a positive case in a healthcare worker. So we all went back Sunday morning. And when we went back, that's when people like Lyle Peterson, Mike Bell, several senior folks came back too, because things were really concerned then. And so Lyle came back, and Lyle and I went to the EOC. And Lyle, after about 3 days, said, "This is ridiculous. I mean, all really the stuff that's happening is happening at the hospital. I need to be at the hospital." And so we basically, unfortunately, left Amy and somebody else in the EOC and pretty much moved operations to the hospital, because the stuff that was going on at EOC was
what was the stuff that was going on there?
They were operating under ICS, and what were they doing? I think the term sometimes we use were spinning for spinning's sake. There was a lot of spinning. They were doing some things. They were trying to arrange. They were arranging a place to move the family. Remember, the family was stuck in that apartment complex, and so they had to move the family. They were tracking a lot of the things, and they were bringing all the different elements of the city into. But it was. I guess part of the problem with Dallas was that you had the city's EOC, but everything was really happening at the hospital. And I'm told later on the judge eventually demanded a place at the hospital, because even it was pretty apparent that nothing was really happening at the EOC.
Right. Can you tell me about working with Dr. David Kuhar?
He is great. One thing I'll tell you about Kuhar that most people do not know. Have you ever seen the movie Office Space?
Yes.
Great movie. And sometimes when, one thing I think one of the most important attributes for outbreaks and tremendously stressful outbreaks is a sense of humor. And somehow we got into the office space. I think I probably started it. And what were the reports called? TPS reports.
Mm-hmm.
So David started asking for some sort of communications report or roll-up or something, and I started making a joke about TPS reports. And then he does some of the best office space impressions I've ever seen. And it came at an incredibly stressful time, and I know he was stressed, and all of us were stressed, because we had left and we had come and we thought it was over and we were over the hump, and all of a sudden we had two healthcare workers who had gone positive. And so I remember David had just this great grace under fire, this sense of humor, even when things were going very difficult. And there was about a week there where we did office space imitations and jokes, and it seemed to get us through. And he just, he was really good. I mean, as tough as things were at that time, I remember one time when we started, we had the hospital workers come up and take their temperature with us. And I remember this guy coming up. He was a huge male nurse. I think he was either male nurse or an orderly. The guy was huge. Could have played linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys. He came up, and he was angry. And he was yelling. And it looked to me like he was going to hit somebody. And I remember grabbing another guy and rushing out there, because I thought somebody's going to have to help out. And I remember David Kuhar walking right up, introducing himself, and then hugging the guy. And then the guy starts crying. And so he took a situation where this guy, I thought he was going to hit somebody. And the next thing I know, he's sobbing. And he tells David, you know, all of us are we're all pariahs. Nobody will talk to us. They all think we're going to have Ebola. We don't know what's going on, you know, and he just unloaded. And I remember David hugging this guy, and you'll probably not hear the story from many people, and he'll never tell it. But I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, that was just what, and then his, the compassion, and you could tell that here was a physician, here was somebody who, and this guy was so frustrated, and he went from complete anger to this emotional breakdown, and as Dave just hugged him and talked him through it. And I remember just thought to myself, that's amazing. And, you know, and by the way, and Dave's having the week of his life in the middle of this, too. And he's able to take this guy off the ledge. But he was, yeah, just amazing.
Wow.
But, and this is in the eye of the storm, too, right? In the middle. I mean, there was one day when Frieden had to go testify. It was that week when we all got called back. And I went, it was like a Thursday he had to go testify. And so you're in Dallas and you're thinking, oh, things have gone so horribly wrong. We got these two healthcare workers are infected. We were thinking Frieden's going to get fired. We were just imagining the worst. And we're blaming ourselves. What did we do wrong here in Dallas? How come we didn't know about these healthcare workers? You know, blah, 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 blah. You know, this one healthcare worker flew. There was just so many things. And so we were told that be somewhere at 4 o'clock. Be by a phone at 4 o'clock. And for some reason, they were working through me, maybe because I was the comms guy. So I'm getting these weird phone calls. You have to have the entire team by the phone at 4 o'clock. And no contractors and no partners. Well, first of all, that bothered me because you are a team. And so there were folks from the Dallas County Health Department who were going out on all the contact tracing, who were working with us. And so how do I tell them, oh, you can't be on this phone call? So we brought everybody in there. And so whether you were a CDC, whether you were a contractor, whether you were Dallas County, because you were on the same team. And at 4 o'clock, we got the, you know, that's when Obama called all the CDC teams in the field. So you had the guys on, there were guys on from Africa, there were guys on from Atlanta EOC, and there was us. And so it was really, you know, we were on a speakerphone, we were all gathered around it. And we had all discussed in advance, nobody's going to say anything stupid. And there were other CDC folks who got on there with an agenda. I remember somebody from the EOC in Atlanta who had deployed to from Africa got on with this long rant, and we're all just hanging our head in embarrassment going, who is this woman and why is she doing this? And then somebody got on from Africa, and they're talking to them, Obama, and this guy from Africa is complaining about not having enough vehicles. I'm thinking, really, you're talking to the POTUS, and you're going to tell him that you need more vehicles? I know he asked, what do you need, but really, this is something that we're not going to waste Obama's time on. So nobody from Dallas said a word. And so there were teams on from like three different African countries, and there was Dallas. And then finally he goes, is Dallas on? And we all yell, yeah, we're on. And he goes, I want to talk to Dallas for a second. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And then he says, you know, I know things are very difficult. And he didn't, for the next 5 minutes, he gave us a pep talk. And I thought to myself, God, whether you like Obama, whether you don't like Obama, this was so good. I mean, because it was a really low point for the Dallas team. And so, I mean, it was just, he goes, I want to talk to Dallas. And he says, I know things are going rough. And I know you guys are working really hard. And it was just really neat. I don't know if anybody's ever told that story, but I can tell you, as someone from the Dallas team who was really, it was sucking. And to get that, and then when he said, I just want to talk to Dallas for a second. And, you know, it was really neat.
Yeah. Do you remember, was that after the index patient had died and the nurses had been infected?
Yeah. It was, we had the two healthcare workers and the death and then, you know, there were all kinds of crazy stuff, and it was just it was a difficult time.
Yeah.
The finger pointing had started, you know, the questions about the PP, it was just, you know, a perfect storm, I guess.
Right. Who are you working, let's see, how do I phrase this question? Before the index patient dies, I'm trying to do this thing where I don't identify names, even though they're publicly known.
Right.
What did most of your communications work entail?
So this was very difficult. There was almost a daily teleconference. And so I would try to get David Kuhar to participate. But what typically happened was that these teleconferences, it would be Dr. Frieden from Atlanta, and then usually the judge or mayor or David Lakey, the medical lead in Texas. And so, and there were things that were breaking every day. So this was very frustrating to us. We would try to get onto a pre-conference mode with Dr. Frieden. And so that, you know, where we at least maybe a half an hour before the phone call started, because we were going to break things at these teleconferences. And so those of us in Dallas, Dr. Lakey, the Judge Jenkins, and the mayor, they wanted to know, what were you going to break and how were you going to break it? But it turns out we were really doing this as we were going. And so I would call back to Atlanta, and I'd try to get, you know, guys, we got, you know, we're ready to announce this, or this has happened. How are we going to message this, or what are we going to do? And then we'll get back to you. And so and then I think Dr. Friesen was able to do one or two, but then it came down to he wasn't able to do the pre-conferences. Either he was being rushed around so much and moving so fast. So there were several phone calls where the judge and the mayor and David Lakey went into the not knowing what Dr. Friesen was going to say, or if they knew something was coming out, not knowing how Dr. Friesen was going to talk about it or who would talk about it. So there was a great deal of anger and frustration on their end. And we were having to do these daily. And then not only did they do that daily teleconference with Dr. Friesen, right after that, they would do one at City Hall or at the judge's office for the local Dallas media, because Judge Jenkins was in a re-election campaign. And so, you know, he's not averse to doing media. And so they would want to do a press conference, their own press conference for their media. And so they would schedule one every day for about 1 o'clock. So you'd have the CDC teleconference at 11, and then, and this is Central Time, then Dallas is one. Well, David Kuhar, God bless him, he's running the team at the hospital. That's the last thing he wants to do is come drive downtown Dallas, which, by the way, was a bit of a hump, and then go into this press conference with the judge and mayor. So I was doing the press conferences for CDC, and there wasn't much to say. I would give the case contact, and I would say what CDC's doing. But there was daily Dallas press conferences as well. And then while that's going on, there's all kinds of events. There's interview requests, and there's all that's going on. And we were trying to, let the reporters cover the case contact tracing, and we couldn't. One day I arranged for all the team to be available, and we brought in all four or five broadcast stations, and they watched the team leader brief the contact tracers, and then they were able to talk to the contact tracers about what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. And we never let reporters go out with the contact tracers, because we viewed the contact tracers, the people, as patients, because they were getting, we were checking them for symptoms and talking to them. And so we thought that if the reporters, they would also influence the interview. So it was, the reporters were demanding, they'd find out who was being traced, that even the people who were willing to have the media there, we'd still say no. So that was a constant battle to be able to tell that story without letting the reporters go. So we were doing a lot of communications. But then at the same time, Dallas County had as a very, that health department, they weren't putting out a lot of material. And if you looked at their website and the educational, and I was telling them pull things from CDC, and we were sending things from CDC on Ebola. But a lot of the stuff was really being written at, I mean, some of those things we hadn't seen surface before. You know, burying the patient's ashes. I think it took months to find a place in Louisiana where they could bury the ashes, which things like that just had never come up.
No doubt. Yeah. And I'm thinking about so many things as you're talking about this, and one of them is just the number of audiences that you're having to think about when you talk about communications. I think, as kind of a layperson to communications, when I think of it, I think of just communicating about health messaging to the general populace. But you're talking about communicating to people in the United States, to the doctors at the hospital, to public health officials in the state level, just everybody. It's remarkable.
Yeah, and you're right. And there were, if you walked outside the hospital, Presby, there were two different satellite truck farms, and so one of them was primarily the local media, and the other one was all the nationals, internationals, and they were permanently there. And the judge would go out there, and this is in addition to his press conference, he would just go out there and do interviews. And a lot of this was difficult because we weren't always in sync. And it was hard you had to kind of figure out what the judge was saying, and then sometimes you had to go back and kind of re-message it or work on it, because we weren't always in sync, and the judge was going to do a lot of media.
Did things change quite a bit after the healthcare workers were diagnosed?
I think so. It really changed dramatically. Yeah, and it was difficult. I mean, and then the hospital, of course, they had it becomes a legal matter for them, and the lawsuits. They're thinking about that, so they were often very difficult to work with. And the hospital had brought in they had their normal communications folks, but they also brought in I had contracted out for a huge crisis communication outfit. And I went to one of those meetings, and then I didn't get invited back. So, and then if it became difficult because, like, let's say that a reporter wanted to talk to one of the CDC team members or just get an update. They would have to come to the hospital because our guys weren't going. If I could get them to take a break, they would literally go stand in front of the hospital and do a quick stand up. But sometimes the hospital would say no, and so you'd have to walk across the street from the hospital to do an interview with CDC folks because they, you know, the hospital was under fire as well, and they weren't always supportive of media. Yet there's these two satellite truck farms there.
You said you didn't get invited back to the meeting with the strategist?
No.
What do you mean?
I guess it's a fundamental difference. We're trying to work through. It's a kind of a crisis as well, and the hospital's got certain interests, and so I've been on several hospital outbreaks, and I did rabies at Baylor Hospital in Dallas, and I've been on other hospitals, and it's always some of the lawyers are worried about the business aspects of it, and you're trying to help them through it. And I think I've been out on over 20 different outbreaks or responses, just at CDC, so I have some experience. But I guess I'm trying to help them tell the story and get through the crisis. But then they've got their lawyers and they're listening, and they've got certain things they're not going to do, even though it doesn't make sense. But they have different interests and different audiences, as you know. So it's oftentimes. We're almost opposed in some things.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. So what happens after Dallas?
After Dallas, I come back, and then in November, New York City.
Yeah.
Which were only there for a week, and New York City was fantastic. These guys had literally gone through an exercise. What happens for the first Ebola case, and then a week later they get their first Ebola case. Their EOC was up and running. I mean, the ICS was going. It was really well done.
What was the work that you did in New York?
I had very little. I mean, there was a little bit of working with their comms guys, a little bit of, you know, setting up some of the CDC guys for interviews, and then working with him a little bit on his messaging and strategy, and then a little bit of our health education material. But actually, I was only up there for a week, and they had a really good handle on it.
Right. Okay. And then after that?
After that was Sierra Leone for the vaccine trials.
Okay.
And then that was February of the next year for about a month.
February of 2015.
Yeah. And so we were working on, we had a couple communicators, Kristen Nordland, who's with me now on my team at NCRD, and myself. And we were working both the kind of the public affairs, media relations, but also some of the health comm side of the vaccine.
What does that mean?
We were, we did a press conference up there. We were working. There were several things going on. One was just handling the questions about the vaccine trial and doing interviews for the team. But there was also, we had health education folks spread out all over the country where we were doing the different trials. So working with them a little bit on the health communication aspects, whether it's doing interviews or their material, or helping them sensitize their audiences. A lot of trying to explain what we're doing with the trials. There were rumors going around. There were all kinds of issues that sprung up around communication or health education and the vaccine trials.
Right. Gotcha. So memories that you have from that month that stand out to you?
Oh, Sierra Leone. That was. I wanted to see, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea were the three big countries. So for me, I kind of wanted to get to one of those three countries and see what the outbreak looked like there. So it was interesting to go to Sierra Leone. I can remember in the very first meeting, it was my in-brief. I had flown in the night before, and everybody had to go to an in-brief. And I remember sitting there on my BlackBerry, and there was a meeting going on, and they were going to announce at that meeting the name of the study to be SLEEVES. Well, if you know anything about Sierra Leone, there was a very long civil war there. Mm-hmm. And in the civil war, sometimes they would ask you if you wanted short sleeves or long sleeves, and they would cut your arm off either here or here, depending on whether you said short or long. So I'm in this in-brief, and I'm thinking to myself, gosh, that's I don't think that's a good name, because when I think of sleeves, I think of Sierra Leone, and I think about the arms being cut off. So I write back to the team lead saying, are you sure about sleeves? And, you know, and so we changed the name to STRIVE, which, you know, it's kind of funny that you think that you're the one to bring it up. But once Danny, that time the team lead for STRIVE was Danny Feinkin, once he kind of brought it up to our partners, our local partners, they kind of said, you know, that's a good point. That might not be the best name. So I remember thinking, that was my first thing about Sierra Leone, is it's sometimes maybe an outside perspective, because maybe they were so close to it. But for me, yeah, the connection automatically, when I heard sleeves, I thought about that tremendous atrocity during the Civil War.
What else do you remember?
Oh, that was really kind of cool. It was, one thing I thought was kind of there was two teams there. There was Strive, who was working on the vaccine, and then there was the regular country team for working on Ebola. And I don't think, and maybe it got better, but I don't think we worked together that well. It almost seems like we were separate teams when I think we could have been one team. And so I felt that when Kristen and I were there, communications is great because it's a great uniter field because everybody needs communicators. So when the New York Times came and they wanted to cover Ebola, Kristen and I handled the New York Times for both the CDC country team and for the Strive team. And so one of the things that's kind of neat about communications is it bridges often or crosses boundaries. So I thought that I did feel like that was one of the things that we could have done better in Sierra Leone. And I'm thinking it got better later on, but it did feel like two different teams when it should have felt like one team.
Did that ever change?
I think it got better. Okay. Yeah, but at that time, it felt like, we were two different teams. And, they're doing vaccine. Oh, they're doing this.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Can you describe Kristen a little bit?
Kristen is fantastic. I hired her out of college when I was in media relations. And I've hired her now three times. I hired her out of college for media relations as a press assistant. Then I hired her when I was in PHPR as a press officer. And I just recently brought her to NCRD. And she has deployed. She deployed to Cleveland for that case. They didn't have a case up there, but we had one of the healthcare workers travel to Cleveland. So she's been to Cleveland. She's been to Sierra Leone, not once, but twice, I think. And she's now she runs my media relations for my center that I run now. So she handles all the media relations for us.
Gotcha. And how about some partners and some, government officials?
Oh, gosh, there's so many guys. In Dallas, the EPIs at the county health department were fantastic. They were, and like I say, we viewed them as part of the team. And the young EIS officers or young EPIs are fantastic. I love working with them in the field. They're just, I was recently in, where was I? Gosh, I was in Brazil for Zika. We had a great team there. I love the EIS officers. They just have such a positive attitude, and they're a lot of fun to work with. So one of the pluses of deploying is the teams, the camaraderie, and the young EIS officers are all, they're gung-ho. I've always enjoyed that.
How about in Sierra Leone?
Sierra Leone, Kristen and I were there. She was fantastic. There's some other, who else was there? Oh, gosh, there's a couple folks I would meet later on. After Sierra Leone, I went to an outbreak in Indiana for
HIV?
Yeah, the HIV outbreak. Yeah, I was there. And there was a couple folks I had met, Heather or Kimmy Pringle, folks that were involved in Sierra Leone I got to work with again. That's always kind of neat when you get to see somebody you did another outbreak with. Yeah, so that's enjoyed. So I forgot about that. Yeah, I did HIV in Indiana. I also did MERS. The first MERS case was in Indiana as well.
Oh, wow. Gotcha. So, yeah, just tell me what you've done in the last year.
So last year was dengue in Hawaii in December. Which was pretty rough assignment, Hawaii in December. And then I was there, was kind of neat. I was there with a woman by the name of Candace Hoffman, who I actually hired at the same time we hired Kristen Nordland. So I brought both of them together. So it was kind of neat to go on an outbreak with Candace as well. And so Candace was there, and we did dengue in Hawaii, then Zika in Brazil, which was a great outbreak. The team leader was Aaron Staples, and he was fantastic to work with. I'm now at the point where sometimes I'll ask who the team leader is because it makes a big difference. And some team leaders will get communications and will really work communicate. Others will say, I don't want to do anything. I don't even know why you're here. And it just makes the outbreak miserable. It's just going to be a battle the whole way. But Aaron was fantastic. I told her I'd go anywhere with her again.
Gotcha.
So yeah, that makes it to me. It makes a big difference who the team leader is.
I want to cycle back to something that you said earlier before we really started getting to the specifics of Ebola, mm-hmm. and that was that kind of in the history of CDC's public communications work. Ebola is a kind of a turning point, right?
Yeah.
This is when CDC starts to get it. What is it about Ebola that you think made this change?
It's interesting to me. We had sent some folks out. We'd sent guys like myself out to do mostly like RISCOM or public affairs. But with Ebola, we saw the need to stand up these health promotion teams. And we, for the first time, we stood up a health promotion team with the JIC. And Craig Manning would be a great guy to talk to. he kind of was the, I guess, the point man or the he got that going. And the purpose of the health promotion team, for the first time we were looking at what do we need, what is the, with WHO they say social mobility, but it's really the health education and the campaigns. What do we need to do on the ground to educate or do social mobilization? And so for the first time, we had, I'd say, a concerted effort to do that. In the past, it was you sent somebody like myself out, and we would do that on the side when we're doing everything else. But we sent out teams to do nothing but social mobilization, and there was a huge need for it because in some places there was, until the CDC folks showed up, there were a few partners, but there wasn't pulling it together. And you know, some of the things like in Sierra Leone, they had the message of the week or the message of the day. They put together campaigns, and they brought all the partners together, and we looked at social mobilization rather than being fragmented, unifying it for some countries. And so Craig was running it. Craig ran it, and he deployed a lot too. That was probably the problem, was Craig was trying to do both. He had tried, and I told him this when we were on the JICA, you're trying to be a responder, but you're also charged with standing this up. So somebody, we had to have a core team back at CDC to kind of round up new volunteers to deploy and make sure those folks who deployed knew what they were doing and had the materials to succeed. So that was, in my mind, I don't think of another outbreak where we've actually looked at health promotion and social mobilization, and we identified a team at CDC to organize it, and we organized it in such a way that we put teams in the field and had a concerted effort. And what we saw in the teams in the field was we saw all these partners and a lot of people doing it, but in many times we were helpful, but and I'm not sure if every country, we were the ones that brought it together, but under Ebola, we saw social mobilization being done in a concerted effort in many of the countries and making a lot of progress.
Who was it then who made this happen for Ebola?
You know what? I would check with Craig. I would start with Craig.
Sure.
Yeah, but Craig, I know, was instrumental back here at CDC.
Sure.
And he had also deployed numerous times, but he got it going, and he kept it going, I think, at CDC and deployed quite a bit. But there was a need for it. I mean, countries were asking for it. I mean, you know, we always needed a communicator on the team, but there were countries that said, look, we really have no Ebola education. I mean, they hadn't seen Ebola in West Africa, so there was so much work to be done. And there were some folks on the ground, but all they needed was, sometimes they just needed the materials. So the health promotion team and the JIC was working on materials in many different languages on all different platforms, whether it was social media or radio PSAs. They were doing a great deal of work to generate material, and all of it was, and they were really good about making it appropriate for that audience, and whether that audience was in Guinea that spoke French or Sierra Leone or Liberia.
Gotcha.
So we just had not had to do that before, and that was probably one of the biggest successes I think of with Ebola, was having this health promotion and taking that really serious and putting something in place in the field and at CDC. And, you know, and there are other folks. I mean, gosh, when you go out there, you sometimes see UNICEF or WHO, but I mean, and oftentimes the local health departments or the ministries of health might have had somebody, but usually they were overwhelmed or they didn't have the resources. And that's a lot of what CDC was able to send people and oftentimes send resources.
Absolutely. So when you're looking back over your Ebola experience, is there anything else that you want to share that, you know, to put on the historical record for people looking back about your experience? Any stories, any memories?
Gosh, it was a crazy year. I guess started with Nigeria and went through Sierra Leone. I mean, a lot of amazing people. I mean, CDC, I always love going out in the field with CDC. I mean, we're the most amazing folks to see some of these, what they go through, what they do, the long hours. I mean, it's incredible. And the thing about Ebola was it demanded so much from the agency. People who had never deployed all of a sudden were deploying. People who had nothing to do with Ebola were now doing Ebola. It was amazing to me. And you know, you walk around the offices now and you'll see it's actually a fan blade from, you've probably seen it from Sierra Leone. They basically took a fan blade and you'll see those proudly displayed, and people got the, it just was, remember the, I don't know if you remember the family nights. The family nights were incredible. We had these big family nights for the Ebola responders where we'd do they would do an awards, and Dr. Frieden would show up, and you'd bring your family to hear the stories about Ebola, and they'd get an EOC tour. To me, that was really incredible because it was more, you know, if you deploy, we all say, oh, look who deployed, that's fantastic. But what you don't understand is when you deploy, you leave behind sometimes a spouse, kids. And so when you deploy, it's really more than you deploying. Plus, it's also the folks in the office who have to do your job while you're gone. So I think that really people came to understand that about Ebola, because a lot of us were deploying who hadn't deployed before. But it takes a village to deploy somebody, because somebody has to do your job, and then your kids and your family and your wife, spouse, all those people sacrifice. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool about Ebola because, you know, before previously an Ebola Marburg outbreak was a very small cadre of people that might go out, and it would be, you know, in a remote area. You might hear about it. You might not hear about it.
Can I take one more minute of your time? Cool. I just want to ask briefly, what's it like going from Ebola to Zika then?
You know, there were some similarities. Of course, everybody on the Zika team had been out for Ebola. But Zika's a different thing because you had the babies, and you had those. The first time we saw those babies, it was really difficult. I'm blessed with four healthy children, but we walked into one clinic, and the doctors on the team grade the babies 1 through 4, and I think 4 being the most severe. Maybe anyway, we saw two babies that were the most severe, and just to see those, I would say in some ways I found Zika very difficult as a parent, just looking at those mothers and those babies and thinking to myself, oh my God, this is so tragic. And some of these women, you would talk to them and they thought they had done something wrong. What did I do wrong? And it was their fault, and they were bitten by a mosquito. Who's not bitten by a mosquito? And how could you, I mean, and these poor mothers, they're looking for answers, and the answer is there's nothing. How do you prevent a mosquito bite? No one even knew. So I would say in some ways the Zika one was, I remember 2 or 3 days in a row going with the team leader to clinics and then telling her, I really don't want to go to another clinic. And I never felt that way about going into an Ebola ward. And I went because I felt I needed support. But it was just very difficult for me. I just felt so, to look at the mothers and the babies and those poor mothers and then not having an answer for them and knowing that they're not going to recover.
Right.
Yeah, I'd say in some ways that was very difficult.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Dave, it's been awesome and educational just sitting here and listening to your experiences.
Thank you. I think it's a great project.
Oh, thank you.